Audio Renaissance presents Old Man's War by John Scalzi. Read for you by William Dufries.
Old Man's War, Part 1, Chapter 1. I did two things on my 75th birthday. I visited my wife's grave, then I joined the army. Visiting Kathy's grave was the less dramatic of the two. She's buried in Harris Creek Cemetery, not more than a mile down the road from where I live and where we raised our family. Getting her into the cemetery was more difficult than perhaps it should have been. Neither of us expected needing the burial, so neither of us made the arrangements. It's somewhat mortifying, to use a rather apt word, to have to argue with a cemetery manager about your wife not having made a reservation to be buried. Eventually my son Charlie, who happens to be mayor, cracked a few heads and got the plot. Being the father of the mayor has its advantages. So, the grave. Simple and unremarkable, with one of those small markers instead of a big headstone. As a contrast, Kathy lies next to Sandra Kane, whose rather oversized headstone is polished black granite, with Sandy's high school photo and some maudlin quote from Keats about the death of youth and beauty sandblasted into the front. That's Sandy all over. It would have amused Kathy to know Sandra was parked next to her with her big dramatic headstone. All their lives, Sandy nurtured an entertainingly passive-aggressive competition with her. Kathy would come to the local bake sale with a pie, Sandy would bring three, and simmer, not so subtly, if Kathy's pie sold first. Kathy would attempt to solve the problem by preemptively buying one of Sandy's pies. It's hard to say whether this actually made things better or worse, from Sandy's point of view. I suppose Sandy's headstone could be considered the last word in the matter, a final show-up that could not be rebutted, because, after all, Kathy was already dead. On the other hand, I don't actually recall anyone visiting Sandy. 3 months after Sandy passed, Steve Kane sold the house and moved to Arizona with a smile as wide as Interstate 10 plastered on his skull. He sent me a postcard sometime later. He was shacking up with a woman down there who had been a porn star 50 years earlier. I felt unclean for a week after getting that bit of information. Sandy's kids and grandkids live one town over, but they might as well be in Arizona for as often as they visit. Sandy's Keats quote probably hadn't been read by anyone since the funeral but me, in passing, as I move the few feet over to my wife. Kathy's marker has her name, Catherine Rebecca Perry, her dates, and the words, "Beloved wife and mother." I read those words over and over every time I visit. I can't help it. They are four words that so inadequately and so perfectly sum up a life. The phrase tells you nothing about her, about how she met each day or how she worked, about what her interests were or where she liked to travel. You'd never know what her favorite color was or how she liked to wear her hair, or how she voted, or what her sense of humor was. You'd know nothing about her except that she was loved. And she was. She'd think that was enough. I hate visiting here. I hate that my wife of 42 years is dead. At one minute, one Saturday morning, she was in the kitchen, mixing a bowl of waffle batter and talking to me about the dust-up at the library board meeting the night before, and the next minute she was on the floor, twitching as the stroke tore through her brain. I hate that her last words were, "Where the hell did I put the vanilla?" I hate that I've become one of those old men who visits a cemetery to be with his dead wife. When I was much younger, I used to ask Kathy what the point would be. A pile of rotting meat and bones that used to be a person isn't a person anymore. It's just a pile of rotting meat and bones. The person is gone, off to heaven or hell or wherever or nowhere. You might as well visit a side of beef. When you get older, you realize this is still the case. You just don't care. It's what you have. For as much as I hate the cemetery, I've been grateful it's here, too. I miss my wife. It's easier to miss her at a cemetery where she's never been anything but dead than to miss her in all the places where she was alive. I didn't stay long. I never do. Just long enough to feel the stab that's still fresh enough after most of 8 years. The one that also serves to remind me that I've got other things to do than to stand around in a cemetery like an old damned fool. Once I felt it, I turned around and left and didn't bother looking around. This was the last time I would ever visit the cemetery or my wife's grave, but I didn't want to expend too much effort in trying to remember it. As I said, this is the place where she's never been anything but dead. There's not much value in remembering that. Although, come to think of it, signing up for the army wasn't all that dramatic either. My town was too small for its own recruiting office. I had to drive into Greenville, the county seat, to sign up. The recruiting office was a small storefront in a nondescript strip mall. There was a state liquor authority store on one side of it, and a tattoo parlor on the other. Depending on what order you went into each, you could wake up the next morning in some serious trouble. The inside of the office was even less appealing, if that's possible. It consisted of a desk with a computer and a printer, a human behind that desk, 2 chairs in front of the desk, and 6 chairs lining a wall. A small table in front of those chairs held recruiting information and some back issues of Time and Newsweek. Kathy and I had been in here a decade earlier, of course. I suspect nothing had been moved, much less changed, and that included the magazines. The human appeared to be new. At least I don't remember the previous recruiter having that much hair. Or breasts. The recruiter was busy typing something on the computer and didn't bother to look up as I came in. "Be right with you," she muttered, by way of a more or less Pavlovian response to the door opening.
"Take your time," I said. "I know the place is packed."
This attempt at marginally sarcastic humor went ignored and unappreciated, which has been par for the course for the last few years. Good to see I had not lost my form. I sat down in front of the desk and waited for the recruiter to finish whatever she was doing.
"You coming or going?" she asked,
still without actually looking up at me.
"Pardon me?" I said.
"Coming or going?" she repeated. "Coming in to do your intent to join sign-up or going out to start your term?"
"Going out, please."
This finally got her to look at me, squinting out through a rather severe pair of glasses.
"You're John Perry," she said.
"Oh, that's me. How did you guess?"
She looked back to her computer.
"Most people who want to enlist come in on their birthday, even though they have 30 days afterwards to formally enlist. We only have 3 birthdays today. Mary Valerie already called to say she won't be going, and you don't look like you'd be Cynthia Smith."
"Well, I'm gratified to hear that," I said.
"And since you're not coming in for an initial sign-up,"
she continued, ignoring yet another stab at humor,
"it stands to reason you're John Perry."
"I could be just a lonely old man wandering around looking for conversation," I said.
"We don't get many of those around here,"
she said.
"They tend to be scared off by the kids next door with the demon tattoos."
She finally pushed her keyboard away and gave me her full attention.
"Now then, let's see some ID, please."
"But you already know who I am,"
I reminded her.
"Let's be sure," she said.
There was not even the barest hint of a smile when she said this. Dealing with garrulous old farts every day had apparently taken its toll. I handed over my driver's license, birth certificate, and national identity card. She took them, reached into her desk for a hand pad, plugged it into the computer, and slid it over to me. I placed my hand on it, palm down, and waited for the scan to finish. She took the pad and slid my ID card down the side to match the print information.
"You're John Perry," she said finally.
"And now we're back where we started," I said. She ignored me. Again.
10 years ago, during your intent to join orientation session, you were provided information concerning the Colonial Defense Force and the obligations and duties you would assume by joining the CDF, she said,
in the tone of voice which indicated that she said this at least once a day, every day, most of her working life.
Additionally, in the interim period, you have been sent refresher materials to remind you of the obligations and duties you would be assuming. At this point, do you need additional information or a refresher presentation, or do you declare that you fully understand the obligations and duties you are about to assume? Be aware there is no penalty either for asking for refresher materials or opting not to join the CDF at this time.
I recalled the orientation session. The first part consisted of a bunch of senior citizens sitting on folding chairs at the Greenville Community Center, eating donuts and drinking coffee and listening to a CDF apparatchik drone on about the history of human colonies. Then he handed out pamphlets on CDF surface life, which appeared to be much like military life anywhere. During the question and answer session, we found out he wasn't actually in the CDF. He had just been hired to provide presentations in the Miami Valley area. The second part of the orientation session was a brief medical exam. A doctor came in and took blood, swabbed the inside of my cheek to dislodge some cells, and gave me a brain scan. Apparently, I passed. Since then, the pamphlet I was provided at the orientation session was sent to me once a year through the mail. I started throwing it out after the second year. I hadn't read it since.
"I understand," I said.
She nodded, reached into her desk, pulled out a piece of paper and a pen, and handed both to me. The paper held several paragraphs, each with a space for a signature underneath. I recognized the paper. I had signed another, very similar paper 10 years earlier to indicate that I understood what I would be getting into a decade in the future.
"I'm going to read to you each of the following paragraphs," she said. "At the end of each paragraph, if you understand and accept what has been read to you, please sign and date on the line immediately following the paragraph. If you have questions, please ask them at the end of each paragraph reading. If you do not subsequently understand or do not accept what has been read and explained to you, do not sign. Do you understand?"
"I understand," I said.
"Very good," she said. "Paragraph 1. I, the undersigned, acknowledge and understand that I am freely and of my own will and without coercion, volunteering to join the Colonial Defense Force for a term of service of not less than 2 years in length. I additionally understand that the term of service may be extended unilaterally by the Colonial Defense Force for up to 8 additional years in times of war and duress."
This 10 years extension clause was not news to me. I did read the information I was sent, once or twice, although I wondered how many people glossed over it, and of those who didn't, how many people actually thought they'd be stuck in the service 10 years. My feeling on it was that the CDF wouldn't ask for 10 years if it didn't feel it was going to need them. Because of the quarantine laws, we don't hear much about colonial wars, but what we do hear is enough to know it's not peacetime out there in the universe. I sighed.
"Paragraph 2. I understand that by volunteering to join the Colonial Defense Force, I agree to bear arms and to use them against the enemies of the Colonial Union, which may include other human forces. I may not, during the term of my service, refuse to bear and use arms as ordered, or cite religious or moral objections to such actions in order to avoid combat service."
How many people volunteer for an army and then claim conscientious objector status? I signed.
Paragraph 3. I understand and agree that I will faithfully and with all deliberate speed execute orders and directives provided to me by superior officers, as provided for in the Uniform Code of Colonial Defense Force Conduct.
I signed.
Paragraph 4. I understand that by volunteering for the Colonial Defense Forces, I consent to whatsoever medical, surgical, or therapeutic regimens or procedures are deemed necessary by the Colonial Defense Forces to enhance combat readiness.
Here it was. why I and countless other 75-year-olds signed up every year. I once told my grandfather that by the time I was his age, they'd have figured out a way to dramatically extend the human lifespan. He laughed at me and told me that's what he had assumed, too, and yet there he was, an old man anyway. And here I am as well. The problem with aging is not one damn thing after another. It's every damn thing, all at once, all the time. You can't stop aging. Gene therapies and replacement organs and plastic surgery give it a good fight, but it catches up with you anyway. Get a new lung and your heart blows a valve. Get a new heart and your liver swells up to the size of an inflatable kiddie pool. Change out your liver, a stroke gives you a whack. That's aging's trump card. They still can't replace brains. Life expectancy climbed up near the 90 years mark a while back, and that's where it's been ever since. We eked out almost another score from the 80, and then God seems to have put his foot down. People can live longer and do live longer, but they still live those years as an old person. Nothing much has ever changed about that. Look, you. When you're 25, 35, 45, or even 55, you can still feel good about your chances to take on the world. When you're 65 and your body is looking down the road at imminent physical ruin, these mysterious medical, surgical, and therapeutic regimens and procedures begin to sound interesting. Then you're 75, friends are dead and you've replaced at least one major organ, you have to pee 4 times a night, and you can't go up a flight of stairs without being a little winded, and you're told you're in pretty good shape for your age. Trading that in for a decade of fresh life in a combat zone begins to look like a hell of a bargain. Especially because if you don't, in a decade you'll be 85, and then the only difference between you and a raisin will be that, while you're both wrinkled and without a prostate, the raisin never had a prostate to begin with. So how does the CDF manage to reverse the flow of aging? No one down here knows. Earthside scientists can't explain how they do it, and can't replicate their successes, though it's not for the lack of trying. The CDF doesn't operate on planet, so you can't ask a CDF veteran. However, the CDF only recruits on planet, so the colonists don't know either, even if you could ask them, which you can't. Whatever therapies the CDF performs are done off-world, in the CDF's own authority zones, away from the purview of global and national governments. So no help from Uncle Sam or anyone else. Every once in a while, a legislature or president or dictator decides to ban CDF recruiting until it reveals its secrets. The CDF never argues. It packs up and goes. Then all the 75-year-olds in that country take long international vacations from which they never return. The CDF offers no explanations, no rationales, no clues. If you want to find out how they make people young again, you have to sign up. I signed.
Paragraph 5. I understand that by volunteering for the Colonial Defense Forces, I am terminating my citizenship in my national political entity, in this case, the United States of America, and also the residential franchise that allows me to reside on the planet Earth. I understand that my citizenship will henceforth be transferred generally to the Colonial Union and specifically to the Colonial Defense Force. I further recognize and understand that by terminating my local citizenship and planetary residential franchise, I am barred from subsequent return to Earth, and upon completion of my term of service within the Colonial Defense Force, will be relocated to whatsoever colony I am allotted by the Colonial Union and/or the Colonial Defense Force. More simply put, you can't go home again. This is part and parcel of the quarantine laws, which were imposed by the Colonial Union and the CDF, officially at least, to protect Earth from any more xenobiological disasters like the crimp. Folks on the Earth were all for it at the time. Funny how insular a planet will become when a third of its male population permanently loses its fertility within the space of a year.
People here are less enthused about it now. They've gotten bored with Earth and want to see the rest of the universe, and they've forgotten all about childless great-uncle Walt. But the CU and CDF are the only ones with spaceships that have the skip drives that make interstellar travel possible. So there it is. This makes the agreement to colonize where the CU tells you to colonize something of a moot point. Since they're the only ones with the ships, you go where they take you anyway. It's not as if they're going to let you drive the starship. A side effect of the quarantine laws and the skip drive monopoly is to make communication between Earth and the colonies, and between the colonies themselves, all but impossible. The only way to get a timely response from a colony is to put a message onto a ship with a skip drive. The CDF will grudgingly carry messages and data for planetary governments this way, but anyone else is out of luck. You could put up a radio dish and wait for communication signals from the colonies to wash by, but Alpha, the closest colony to Earth, is 83 light-years away. This makes lively gossip between planets difficult. I've never asked, but I would imagine that it is this paragraph that causes the most people to turn back. It's one thing to think you want to be young again. It's quite another thing to turn your back on everything you've ever known, everyone you've ever met or loved, and every experience you've ever had over the span of 7.5 decades. It's a hell of a thing to say goodbye to your whole life. I signed.
Paragraph 6, final paragraph, the recruiter said. I recognize and understand that as of 72 hours of the final signing of this document, or my transport off Earth by the Colonial Defense Force, whichever comes first, I will be presumed as deceased for the purposes of law in all relevant political entities, in this case the State of Ohio and the United States of America. Any and all assets remaining to me will be dispensed with according to law. All legal obligations or responsibilities that by law terminate at death will be so terminated. All previous legal records, be they meritorious or detrimental, will be hereby stricken, and all debts discharged according to law. I recognize and understand that I have not yet arranged for the distribution of my assets, that at my request, the Colonial Defense Force will provide me with legal and financial counsel to do so within 72 hours.
I signed. I now had 72 hours to live, so to speak. Now what happens if I don't leave the planet within 72 hours? I said as I handed the paper back to the recruiter.
Nothing, she said, taking the form. Except that since you're legally dead, all your belongings are split up according to your will, your health and life benefits are canceled or dispersed to your heirs, and being legally dead, you have no legal right to protection under the law from everything from libel to murder.
So someone could just come up and kill me and there would be no legal repercussions?
Well, no, she said. If someone were to murder you while you were legally dead, I believe that here in Ohio they could be tried for disturbing a corpse.
Fascinating, I said.
However,
she continued in her ever more distressing matter-of-fact tone,
it usually doesn't get that far. Any time between now and the end of those 72 hours you can simply change your mind about joining. Just call me here. If I'm not here, an automated call responder will take your name. Once we've verified it's actually you requesting cancellation of enlistment, you'll be released from further obligation. Bear in mind that such cancellation permanently bars you from future enlistment. This is a one-time thing.
Got it, I said. Do you need to swear me in?
Nope, she said. I just need to process this form and give you your ticket.
She turned back to her computer, typed for a few minutes, and then pressed the enter key.
The computer is generating your ticket now, she said. It'll be a minute.
Okay, I said. Mind if I ask you a question?
I'm married, she said.
That wasn't what I was going to ask, I said. Do people really proposition you?
All the time, she said. It's really annoying.
Sorry about that, I said. She nodded. What I was going to ask was if you've actually ever met anyone from CDF.
You mean apart from enlistees?
I nodded.
No. The CDF has a corporation down here that handles recruiting, but none of us are actual CDF. I don't think even the CEO is. We get all our information and materials from the Colonial Union Embassy staff and not the CDF directly. I don't think they come Earthside at all.
Does it bother you to work for an organization you never met?
No, she said. The work is okay and the pay is surprisingly good, considering how little money they've put in to decorate around here. Anyway, you're going to join an organization you've never met. Doesn't that bother you?
No, I admitted. I'm old, my wife is dead, and there's not much reason to stay here anymore. Are you going to join when the time comes?
She shrugged. I don't mind getting old.
I didn't mind getting old when I was young either, I said. It's the being old now that's getting to me.
Her computer printer made a quiet hum, and a business card-like object came out. She took it and handed it to me.
This is your ticket, she said to me. It identifies you as John Perry and a CDF recruit. Don't lose it. Your shuttle leaves from right in front of this office in 3 days to go to the Dayton Airport. It departs at 8:30 a.m. We suggest you get here early. You'll be allowed only one carry-on bag, so please choose carefully among the things you wish to take. From Dayton, you'll take the 11 a.m. flight to Chicago and then the 2 p.m. Delta to Nairobi from there. They're 7 hours ahead in Nairobi, so you'll arrive there about midnight, local time. You'll be met by a CDF representative, and you'll have the option of either taking the 2 a.m. Beanstalk to Colonial Station or getting some rest and taking the 9 a.m. Beanstalk. From there, you're in the CDF's hands. I took the ticket.
What do I do if any of these flights is late or delayed?
None of these flights has ever experienced a single delay in the 5 years I've worked here, she said.
Wow,
I said.
I'll bet the CDF's trains run on time, too.
She looked at me blankly.
You know, I said, I've been trying to make jokes to you the entire time I've been here.
I know, she said. I'm sorry, my sense of humor was surgically removed as a child.
Oh, I said.
That was a joke, she said,
and stood up, extending her hand.
Oh! I stood up and took it.
Congratulations, recruit, she said. Good luck to you out there in the stars. I actually mean that, she added.
Well, thank you, I said. I appreciate it.
She nodded, sat back down again, and flicked her eyes back to the computer. I was dismissed. On the way out, I saw an older woman walking across the parking lot towards the recruiting office. I walked over to her.
Cynthia Smith? I asked.
Yes,
she said. How did you know?
I just wanted to say happy birthday, I said, and then pointed upwards. And that maybe I'll see you again up there. She smiled as she figured it out. Finally, I made someone smile that day. Things were looking up.
Chapter 2 Nairobi was launched from underneath us and dropped away. We walked over to the side as if on a fast elevator, which is, of course, exactly what the beanstalk is, and watched the earth begin its slide.
They look like ants from up here.
Leon Deek cackled as he stood next to me.
Black ants!
I had the strong urge to crack open a window and hurl Leon out of it. Alas, there was no window to crack. The beanstalk's window was the same diamond composite materials as the rest of the platform, made transparent so travelers could sightsee below them. The platform was airtight, which would be a handy thing in just a few minutes when we were high enough up that cracking a window would lead to explosive decompression, hypoxia, and death. So Leon would not find himself making a sudden and entirely unexpected return to the Earth's embrace. More's the pity. Leon had attached himself to me in Chicago like a fat, brat, and beer-filled tick.
I was amazed that someone whose blood was clearly half pork grease had made it to age 75. I spent part of the flight to Nairobi listening to him fart and expound darkly his theory of the racial composition of the colonies. The farts were the most pleasant part of that monologue. Never had I been so eager to purchase headphones for the in-flight entertainment. I had hoped to ditch him by opting to take the first stock out of Nairobi. He seemed like the kind of guy who'd need a rest after busily passing gas all day. No such luck. The idea of spending another 6 hours with Leon and his farts was more than I could take. If the beanstalk platform had windows and I couldn't hurl Leon out of one, I might have jumped myself. Instead, I excused myself from Leon's presence by telling him the only thing that seemed to hold him at bay, which was by saying I had to go relieve myself. Leon grunted his permission. I wandered off counterclockwise in the general direction of the restrooms, but more specifically to see if I could find a place where Leon might not find me. This was not going to be easy to do. The stock platform was donut-shaped, with a diameter of about 100 feet. The hole of the donut, where the platform slid up the stock, was about 20 feet wide. The cable's diameter was obviously slightly less than that, perhaps about 18 feet, which, if you thought about it, hardly seemed thick enough for a cable several thousand miles long. The rest of the space was filled with comfortable booths and couches where people could sit and chat, and small areas where travelers could watch entertainment, play games, or eat. And, of course, there were lots of window areas to look out of, either down to the earth, across to other stock cables and platforms, or up towards Colonial Station. Overall, the platform gave the impression of being the lobby of a pleasant economy hotel, suddenly launched toward geostationary orbit. The only problem was that the open design made it difficult to hide. The launch was not heavily subscribed. There weren't enough other passengers to hide by blending in. I finally decided to get something to drink at a kiosk near the center of the platform, roughly opposite of where Leon was standing. Sightlines being what they were, that's where I stood the best chance of avoiding him the longest. Leaving Earth physically had been an irritating thing, thanks to Leon's obnoxiousness, but leaving it emotionally had been surprisingly easy. I had decided a year before my departure that, yes, I would join the CDF. From there, it was simply a matter of making arrangements and saying goodbyes. When Kathy and I had originally decided to join up a decade earlier, we put the house in our son Charlie's name, as well as our own, so that he could take possession of it without having to go through probate. Kathy and I otherwise owned nothing of any real value, just the bric-a-brac that you pile up in a life. Most of the really nice stuff was dispersed to friends and family over the last year. Charlie would deal with the rest of it later. Leaving people was not that much harder. People reacted to the news with varying levels of surprise and sadness, since everyone knows that once you join the Colonial Defense Force, you don't come back. But it's not entirely like dying. They know that somewhere out there you're still alive. Heck, maybe after a while they might even come and join you. It's a little what I imagine people felt hundreds of years ago when someone they knew hitched up a wagon and headed west. They cried. They missed them. They got back to what they were doing. Anyway, I told people a whole year before I left that I was going. That's a lot of time to say what you have to say, to settle matters and to make your peace with someone. Over the course of the year, I had had a few sit-downs with old friends and family and did a final poking of old wounds and ashes. In nearly every case, it ended well. A couple of times, I asked forgiveness for things I didn't particularly feel sorry about, and in one case, I found myself in bed with someone who otherwise I'd rather I hadn't. But you do what you have to do to give people closure. It makes them feel better, and it doesn't cost you much to do it. I'd rather apologize for something I didn't really care about and leave someone here on Earth wishing me well than to be stubborn and have that someone hoping that some alien would slurp out my brains. Call it karmic insurance. Charlie had been my major concern. Like many fathers and sons, we'd had our go-rounds. I wasn't the most attentive father, and he wasn't the most self-directed son, wandering through life well into his 30s. When he originally found out that Kathy and I intended to join, he had exploded at us. He reminded us that we had protested against the subcontinental war. He reminded us that we'd always taught him violence wasn't the answer. He reminded us that we'd once grounded him for a month when he'd gone out target shooting with Bill Young, which we both thought was a little odd for a man of 35 to bring up. Kathy's death ended most of our battles, because both he and I realized that most of the things we argued about simply didn't matter. I was a widower, and he a bachelor, and for a while he and I were all we had left. Not long thereafter he met and married Lisa, and about a year after that he became a father and was re-elected mayor, all in one very hectic night. Charlie had been a late bloomer, but it was a fine bloom. He and I had our own sit-down where I apologized for some things, sincerely, and also told him equally sincerely how proud I was of the man he had become. Then we sat on the porch with our beers, watched my grandson Adam swat a t-ball in the front yard, and talked about nothing of any importance for a nice long time. When we parted well and with love, which is what you want between fathers and sons. I stood there by the kiosk, nursing my Coke and thinking about Charlie and his family, when I heard Leon's voice grumbling, followed by another voice, low, sharp, and female, saying something in response. In spite of myself, I peered over past the kiosk. Leon had apparently managed to corner some poor woman and was no doubt sharing whatever dumbass theory his beef-witted brainstem was promulgating at the moment. My sense of chivalry overcame my desire to hide. I went to intervene.
"All I'm saying," Leon was saying, "is that it's not exactly fair that you and I and every American has to wait until we're older than shit to get our chance to go, while all those little Hindis get carted off to brand new worlds as fast as they can breed, which is pretty damn quick. That's just not fair. Does it seem fair to you?"
"No, it doesn't seem particularly fair," the woman said. "But I suppose they wouldn't see it as fair that we wiped New Delhi and Bombay off the face of the planet either."
"That's exactly my point," Leon exclaimed. "We nuked the Dotheads. We won that war. Winning should count for something. And now look what happens. They lost, but they get to go colonize the universe, and the only way we get to go is if we sign up to protect them. Excuse me for saying so, but doesn't the Bible say, 'The meek shall inherit the earth'? I'd say losing a goddamn war makes you pretty damn meek."
"I don't think that phrase means what you think it does, Leon," I said, approaching the two of them.
"John! See, here's a man who knows what I'm talking about,"
Leon said, grinning my way. The woman turned to face me.
"You know this gentleman?"
she asked me, with an undercurrent in her voice that implied that if I did, there was clearly something wrong with me. "Yeah, we met on the trip to Nairobi," I said, gently raising an eyebrow to indicate that he wasn't my companion of choice. "I'm John Perry," I said.
"Jesse Gonzalez," she said.
"Charmed," I replied, and then turned to Leon. "Now, Leon," I said, "you've got the saying wrong. The actual saying is from the Sermon on the Mount, and it says, 'Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth.' Inheriting the earth is meant to be a reward, not a punishment." Leon blinked, then snorted.
"Well, even so, we beat them. We kicked their little brown asses. We should be colonizing the universe, not them."
I opened my mouth to respond, but Jesse beat me to the punch.
"Blessed are they which are persecuted, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven," she said,
speaking to Leon but looking sidelong at me. Leon gaped for a minute at the both of us.
"You can't be serious," he said after a minute. "There's nothing in the Bible that says we should be stuck on Earth while a bunch of brownies, which don't even believe in Jesus, thank you very much, fill up the galaxy. And it certainly doesn't say anything about us protecting the little bastards while they do it. Christ, I had a son in that war. Some dothead shot off one of his balls. His balls! They deserved what they got, the sons of bitches. Don't ask me to be happy that now I'll have to save their sorry asses up there in the colonies."
Jesse winked at me.
"Would you like to field this one?"
"If you don't mind," I said.
"Oh, not at all,"
she replied. "But I say unto you, love your enemies," I quoted. "Bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven, for he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust." Leon turned lobster red.
"You're both out of your fucking gourds," he said,
and stomped off as fast as his fat would carry him. "Thank you, Jesus," I said. "And this time I mean it literally."
"You're pretty handy with a Bible quotation,"
Jesse said.
"Were you a minister in your past life?"
"No," I said. "But I lived in a town of 2,000 people and 15 churches. It helped to be able to speak the language. And you don't have to be religious to appreciate the Sermon on the Mount. What's your excuse?"
"Catholic school religion class,"
she said.
"I won a ribbon for memorization in the 10th grade. It's amazing what your brain can keep in storage for 60 years, even if these days I can't remember where I parked when I go to the store."
"Well, in any event, let me apologize for Leon," I said. "I barely know him, but I know enough to know he's an idiot."
"Judge not, that ye be not judged,"
Jesse said, and shrugged.
"Anyway, he's only saying what a lot of people believe. I think it's stupid and wrong, but that doesn't mean I don't understand it. I wish that there had been a different way for me to see the colonies than to wait an entire life and have to join the military for it. If I could have been a colonist when I was younger, I would have."
"Well, you're not joining for a life of military adventure, then, hmm?" I said.
"Of course not,"
Jesse said, a little scornfully.
"Did you join because you have a great desire to fight a war?"
"No," I said. She nodded.
"Neither did I. Neither did most of us. Your friend Leon certainly didn't join to be in the military. He can't stand the people we will protect. People join because they're not ready to die and they don't want to be old. They join because life on Earth isn't interesting past a certain age. Or they join to see someplace new before they die. That's why I joined, you know. I'm not joining to fight or be young again. I just want to see what it's like to be somewhere else."
She turned to look out the window.
"Of course. It's funny to hear me say that. Do you know that until yesterday I'd never been out of the state of Texas my entire life?"
"Don't feel bad about it," I said. "Texas is a big state." She smiled.
"Thank you. I don't really feel bad about it. It's just funny. When I was a child, I used to read all the young colonist novels and watch the shows and dreamed about raising Arcturian cattle and battling vicious landworms on Colony Gamma Prime. Then I got older and realized that colonists came from India and Kazakhstan and Norway, where they can't support the population they have. And the fact I was born in America meant that I wouldn't get to go, and that there weren't actually Arcturian cattle or landworms. I was very disappointed to learn that when I was 12.
She shrugged again.
"I grew up in San Antonio, went away to college at the University of Texas, and then took a job back in San Antonio. I got married eventually, and we took our vacations on the Gulf Coast. For our 30th anniversary, my husband and I planned to go to Italy, but we never went."
"What happened?"
She laughed. His secretary is what happened. They ended up going to Italy on their honeymoon. I stayed home. On the other hand, they both ended up getting shellfish poisoning in Venice, so it's just as well I never went. But I didn't worry much about traveling after that. I knew I was going to join up as soon as I could, and I did, and here I am. Although now I wish I had traveled more. I took the Delta from Dallas to Nairobi. That was fun. I wish I'd done it more than once in my life. Not to mention this.
She waved her hand at the window towards the beanstalk cables.
Which I never thought I would ever want to ride in my life. I mean, what's keeping this cable up?
Belief, I said. You believe that it won't fall, and it won't. Try not to think about it too much, or we're all in trouble.
What I believe, Jesse said, is that I want to get something to eat. Care to join me?
Belief, Harry Wilson said, and laughed. Maybe belief is holding up this cable, because it sure as hell isn't fundamental physics.
Harry Wilson had joined Jesse and me at a booth where we were eating.
You two look like you know each other, and that's one up on everyone else here,
he said to us as he came up. We invited him to join us, and he accepted gratefully. He had taught physics at a Bloomington, Indiana high school for 20 years, he said, and the beanstalk had been intriguing him the entire time we had been riding it.
What do you mean, physics isn't holding it up?
Jesse said.
Believe me, this is not what I want to hear right at this moment.
Harry smiled.
Well, sorry. Let me rephrase. Physics is involved in holding up this beanstalk, certainly. But the physics involved aren't of the garden variety. There's a lot going on here that doesn't make sense on the surface.
I feel a physics lecture coming on, I said.
I taught physics to teenagers for years,
Harry said, and dug out a small notepad and a pen.
It'll be painless, trust me. Okay, now look.
Harry began drawing a circle at the bottom of the page.
This is the Earth, and this,
he drew a smaller circle halfway up the page,
is Colonial Station. It's in geosynchronous orbit, which means it stays put relative to the Earth's rotation. It's always hanging above Nairobi. With me so far?
We nodded.
Okay. Now, the idea behind the beanstalk is that you connect Colonial Station with the Earth through a beanstalk, a bunch of cables like those out the window, and a bunch of elevator platforms like the one we're on now that can travel back and forth.
Harry drew a line signifying the cable and a small square signifying our platform.
The idea here is that elevators on these cables don't have to reach escape velocity to get to Earth orbit like a rocket payload would. Well, this is good for us, because we don't have to go to Colonial Station feeling like an elephant had its foot on our chests. Simple enough? The thing is, this beanstalk doesn't conform to the basic physical requirements of a classic Earth-to-space beanstalk. For one thing,
Harry drew an additional line past Colonial Station to the end of the page.
Colonial Station shouldn't be at the end of the beanstalk. For reasons that have to do with mass balance and orbital dynamics, there should be additional cable extending tens of thousands of miles past Colonial Station. Without this counterbalance, any beanstalk should be inherently unstable and dangerous.
And you're saying this one isn't, I said.
Not only is it not unstable, it's probably the safest way to travel that's ever been devised, Harry said. The beanstalk has been in continuous operation for over a century. It's the only point of departure for colonists. There's never been an accident due to instability or material failure, which would be related to instability. There was the famous beanstalk bombing 40 years ago, but that was sabotage, unrelated to the physical structure of the beanstalk itself. The beanstalk itself is admirably stable and has been since it was built, but according to basic physics, it shouldn't be.
So what is keeping it up?
Jesse said. Harry smiled again.
Well, that's the question, isn't it?
You mean you don't know?
Jesse asked.
I don't know,
Harry admitted. But that in itself should be no cause for alarm, since I am, or was, merely a high school physics teacher. However, as far as I know, no one else has much of a clue how it works either. On Earth, I mean. Obviously, the Colonial Union knows. Well, how can that be? I asked. It's been here for a century, for God's sake. No one's bothered to figure out how it actually works? Well, I didn't say that, Harry said. Of course, they've been trying, and it's not like it's been a secret all these years. When the beanstalk was being built, there were demands by governments and the press to know how it worked. The CU essentially said, figure it out, and that was that. In physics circles, people have been trying to solve it ever since. It's called the beanstalk problem. Not a very original title, I said. Well, physicists save their imagination for other things. Harry chuckled. The point is, it hasn't been solved, primarily for two reasons. The first is that it's incredibly complicated. I've pointed out the mass issues, but then there are other issues, like cable strength, beanstalk oscillations brought on by storms and other atmospheric phenomena, and even an issue about how cables are supposed to taper. Any of these is massively difficult to solve in the real world. Trying to figure them all out at once is impossible.
What's the second reason?
Jesse asked. Well, the second reason is that there's no reason to. Even if we did figure out how to build one of these things, we couldn't afford to build it. Harry leaned back.
Just before I was a teacher, I worked for General Electric's Civil Engineering Department. We were working on the subatlantic rail line at the time, and one of my jobs was to go through old projects and project proposals to see if any of the technology or practices had application to the subatlantic project. Sort of a Hail Mary attempt to see if we could do anything to bring down costs.
General Electric bankrupted itself on that, didn't they? I asked.
Now you know why they wanted to bring down costs, Harry said. And why I became a teacher. General Electric couldn't afford me or much of anyone else right after that. Anyway, I'm going through old proposals and reports, and I get into some classified stuff. And one of the reports is for a beanstalk. General Electric had been hired by the U.S. government for a third-party feasibility study on building a beanstalk in the Western Hemisphere. They wanted to clear out a hole in the Amazon the size of Delaware and stick it right on the equator. General Electric told them to forget it. The proposal said that even assuming some major technological breakthroughs, most of which still haven't happened and none of which approach the technology that has to be involved with this beanstalk, the budget for the beanstalk would be 3 times the annual gross national product of the United States economy. That's assuming that the project did not run over budget, which of course it almost certainly would have. Now, this was 20 years ago, and the report I saw was a decade old even then, but I don't expect that the costs have gone down very much since then. So, no new beanstalks. There are cheaper ways of getting people and material into orbit, much cheaper.
Harry leaned forward again.
Which leads to 2 obvious questions. How did the Colonial Union manage to create this technological monstrosity? And why did they bother with it at all?
Well, obviously the Colonial Union is more technologically advanced than we are here on Earth,
Jesse said.
Obviously,
Harry said.
But why? Colonists are human, after all. Not only that, but since the colonies specifically recruit from impoverished countries with population problems, colonists tend to be poorly educated. Once they get to their new homes, you have to assume they're spending more time staying alive than they are thinking up creative ways to build beanstalks. And the primary technology that allowed interstellar colonization is the skip drive, which was developed right here on Earth, and which has been substantially unimproved for more than a century. So on the face of it, there's no reason why the colonists should be any more technologically advanced than we are.
Something suddenly clicked in my head. Unless they cheat, I said. Harry grinned.
Exactly. That's what I think, too.
Jesse looked at me, and then Harry.
I'm not following you two, she said.
Well, they cheat, I said. Look, here on Earth, we're bottled up. We only learn from ourselves. We make discoveries and refine technology all the time, but it's slow because we do all the work ourselves. But up there, humans meet other intelligent species, Harry said, some of which almost certainly have technology more advanced than ours. We either take it in trade or reverse engineer it and find out how it works. It's much easier to figure out how something works when you've got something to work from than it is to figure it out on your own. That's what makes it cheating, I said. The CU is reading off someone else's notes.
Well, why doesn't the Colonial Union share what it's discovered with us?
Jesse asked.
What's the point of keeping it to themselves?
Maybe they think that what we don't know can't hurt us, I said. Or it's something else entirely, Harry said, and waved toward the window where the beanstalk cable slid by.
This beanstalk isn't here because it's the easiest way to get people to Colonial Station, you know. It's here because it's one of the most difficult, in fact, the most expensive, most technologically complex, and most politically intimidating way to do it. Its very presence is a reminder that the CU is literally light years ahead of anything humans can do here.
I've never found it intimidating, Jesse said. I really never thought about it much at all.
The message isn't aimed at you, Harry said. If you were President of the United States, however, you'd think of it differently. After all, the CU keeps us all here on Earth. There's no space travel except what the CU allows through colonization or enlistment. Political leaders are always under pressure to buck the CU and get their people to the stars. But the beanstalk is a constant reminder. It says, until you can make one of these, don't even think of challenging us. And the beanstalk is only the technology the CU has decided to show us. Think about what they haven't let us know about. I can guarantee you the U.S. president has, and that it keeps him and every other leader on the planet in line.
None of this is making me feel friendly towards the Colonial Union, Jesse said.
It doesn't have to be sinister, Harry said. It could be that the CU is trying to protect Earth. The universe is a big place. Maybe we're not in the best neighborhood.
Harry, were you always this paranoid? I asked. Or was this something that crept up on you as you got older?
How do you think I made it to 75? Harry said, and grinned. Anyway, I don't have any problems with the CU being much more technologically advanced. It's about to work to my advantage.
He held up an arm.
Look at this thing, he said. It's flabby and old and not in very good shape. Somehow, the Colonial Defense Force is going to take this arm and the rest of me and whip it into fighting shape. And do you know how?
No, I said. Jesse shook her head.
Neither do I, Harry said, and let his arm down with a plop onto the table. I have no idea how they'll make it work. What's more, it's likely that I can't even imagine how they'll do it. If we assume that we've been held in a state of technological infancy by the CU, trying to explain it to me now would be like trying to explain this beanstalk platform to someone who's never seen a mode of transportation more complex than a horse and buggy. But they've obviously made it work. Otherwise, why would they recruit 75-year-olds? The universe isn't going to be conquered by legions of geriatrics. No offense, he added quickly.
None taken,
Jesse said, and smiled.
Lady and gentlemen,
Harry said, looking at the both of us,
we may think we have some idea of what we're getting into, but I don't think we have the first clue. This beanstalk exists to tell us that much. It's bigger and stranger than we can imagine, and it's just the first part of this journey. What comes next is going to be even bigger and stranger. Prepare yourself as best you can.
How dramatic, Jesse said, dryly. I don't know how to prepare myself after a statement like that.
I do, I said, and scooted over to get out of the booth. I'm going to go pee. If the universe is bigger and stranger than I can imagine, it's best to meet it with an empty bladder.
Spoken like a true Boy Scout, Harry said.
Yeah, a Boy Scout wouldn't need to pee as much as I do, I said.
Sure he would, Harry said. Just give him 60 years.
Chapter 3
I don't know about you two, Jesse was saying to me and Harry, but so far this really isn't what I expected the army to be.
It's not so bad, I said. Here, have another donut.
I don't need another donut, she said, taking the donut anyway. What I need is some sleep.
I knew what she meant. It had been more than 18 hours since I left home, nearly all of it consumed with travel. I was ready for a nap. Instead, I was sitting in the huge mess hall of an interstellar cruiser, having coffee and donuts with about 1,000 other recruits, waiting for someone to come and tell us what we were supposed to do next. That part, at least, was pretty much like the military I expected. The rush and wait began on arrival. As soon as we got off the Beanstalk platform, we were greeted by 2 Colonial Union apparatchiks. They informed us that we were the last recruits expected for a ship that was leaving soon, so could we please follow them quickly so that everything could stay on schedule. Then one took the lead and one went to the rear, and they effectively, and rather insultingly, herded several dozen senior citizens across the entire station to our ship, the CDFS Henry Hudson. Jesse and Harry were clearly disappointed at the rush job, as was I. Colonial Station was huge, over 1 mile in diameter, 1,800 meters, actually, and I suspected that after 75 years of life I would finally have to start getting used to the metric system, and served as the sole port of transport for recruits and colonists alike. Being herded across it without being able to stop and take it in was like being 5 years old and being hustled through a toy store at Christmas time by a harried parent. I felt like plopping down on the floor and having a tantrum until I got my way. I was unfortunately too old, or alternately not near old enough, to get away with that sort of behavior. What I did see on our speedy trek was a tantalizing appetizer. As our apparatchiks poked and prodded us along, we passed a huge holding bay filled to capacity with what I would guess were Pakistanis or Muslim Indians. Most were waiting patiently to gain entrance to shuttles that would take them to an immense colony transport ship, one of which was visible in the distance, floating outside the window. Others could be seen arguing with CU officials about one thing or another in accented English, comforting children who were clearly bored or digging through their belongings for something to eat. In one corner, a group of men were kneeling on a carpeted area of the bay and praying. I wondered briefly how they had determined where Mecca was from 23,000 miles up, and then we were pushed forward and I lost sight of them. Jesse tugged on my sleeve and pointed to our right. In a small mess area, I caught a glimpse of something tentacled and blue, holding a martini. I alerted Harry. He was so intrigued that he went back and looked, much to the consternation of the trailing apparatchik. She shooed Harry back into the herd with a sour look on her face. Harry, on the other hand, was grinning like a fool.
"A gihar," he said. "It was eating a buffalo wing when I looked in. Disgusting."
Then he giggled. The Gihar were one of the first intelligent aliens humans encountered, in the days before the Colonial Union established its monopoly on space travel. Nice enough people, but they ate by injecting their food with acid from dozens of thin head tentacles, and then noisily slurping the resulting goop into an orifice.
Ugh, messy.
Harry didn't care. He had spotted his first live alien. Our slow meander reached its conclusion as we approached a holding bay with the words, Henry Hudson, CDF Recruits, glowing from a flight display. Our group gratefully took seats while our apparatchiks went to talk with some other colonials waiting by the shuttle gate door. Harry, who was clearly showing a tendency towards curiosity, wandered over to the bay window to look at our ship. Jesse and I wearily got up and followed him. A small informational monitor at the window helped us find it among the other traffic. The Henry Hudson was not actually docked at the gate, of course. It's hard to make a 100,000-metric-ton interstellar spacecraft move daintily in tandem with a revolving space station. As with the colony transports, it maintained a reasonable distance while supplies, passengers, and crew were transported back and forth by rather more manageable shuttles and barges. The Hudson itself was stationed a few miles out and above the station, not the massive, unaesthetically functional, spoked-wheeled design of the colony transports, but sleeker, flatter, and, importantly, not at all cylindrical or wheel-shaped. I mentioned this to Harry, who nodded.
"Full-time artificial gravity," he said, "and stable over a large field. Very impressive."
"I thought we were using artificial gravity on the way up,"
Jesse said.
"We were," Harry said. "The Beanstalk platform's gravity generators were increasing their output the higher up we went."
"So what's so different about a spaceship using artificial gravity?"
Jesse asked.
"Well, it's just extremely difficult," Harry said. "It takes an enormous amount of energy to create a gravitational field, and the amount of energy you have to put out increases exponentially."